Hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM, 102.7, 103.9, and coming at you from the center of the universe, and that, of course, is Clear Creek County, Colorado. We're up in the loft of the United Center in the Goat Shack. This is The Rabbit Hole, and with me, special guest today, candidate for United States Senate, Dan Baird. Dan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And you've been in this, how long ago did you declare? Several months now?
Yeah, April 16th.
Okay. And talk a bit about you, you know, your background. I believe you're native born, you know. Are you a skier or anything like that? And, you know, why you're running for Senate and also your qualifications. What makes you unique here among all the candidates?
So I guess I'm probably not a typical candidate for U.S. Senate in that I haven't had a career in politics. I've had a career in public service, but not in politics. I was born in Denver, grew up in Golden and Littleton. I went to Heritage High School. I went off to Harvard and then Oxford for a doctorate. And after finishing my PhD, I spent some time in the private sector and then taught at a business school. I was an ethics professor, actually, at Georgetown Business School.
Oh.
And I like to say that being an ethics professor at a business school is a little bit like being a safe sex counselor at an orgy. Everybody knows why you're there. They're not terribly interested, many of them, in what you have to tell them. But and after I spent some time working on business and human rights issues in that capacity, and I ended up joining the Obama administration first as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Secretary Clinton for 4 years, working on human rights around the world, and then as U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is kind of, I like to say, like a mini UN. It involves all of the former Soviet states, European countries, including those that aren't in NATO, as well as Canada and the US. So 57 countries around a table, and it operates on consensus. It arose out of the Cold War, and it was a meeting place for East and West. And, you know, when the 2016 election happened, I think it was a seismic event for many of us. For me, it also meant that I was going to be unemployed and evicted because my husband and I were going to have to leave, obviously, Vienna. And on the night of the election, my husband turned to me and said, you know, the values that you've dedicated your career to and that we care most about are most meaningfully and importantly under threat at home. And we need to go home and be part of a community that cares about those values and be in the fight to make good things happen. In as much as the 2016 election was depressing and a sign of crisis, I think the 2018 election was a reminder of the possibility of making progress through politics. At that point, I was in Governor Hickenlooper's cabinet running the Department of Higher Education for the state. You know, when in the weeks after the 2018 election, as I reflected on it, what seemed to me most remarkable is that despite all the attacks from President Trump on institutions of our democracy, including the free press, despite the hateful rhetoric emanating from the White House, people didn't give up. They didn't give up on the institutions of our democracy. What we did was organize and knock on doors and make phone calls and donate to candidates and write postcards and vote and win. And we won 40 seats. We flipped 40 seats in the House. And we flipped a lot of those seats with candidates who look like me, candidates who had not held elected office before, who had a record in public service, particularly in foreign policy or national security, and who could present themselves as public servants who are willing to go to work in doing not only the hard work on the policy side, but also the hard work on reinforcing the values and institutions on which our democracy depends and which are so under threat in this moment. And I turned to my husband and said, you know, towards the end of last year, beginning of this year, you know, I'm not that enthusiastic about running a campaign that is about Dan Baer, but running a campaign against cynicism in a moment when I think cynicism is the existential political threat that we face, that we give up on the system and cede the field to Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump, which is exactly what Mitch McConnell has been trying to engineer for the last 30 years, you know, I think that is the threat, that we must stay in the game. We must continue to fight forward because if we let go, if we turn away from making progress through politics, we have lost.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to hear your background. I'm learning a whole lot more about you, you know, your professorship and having a doctorate, and I knew you were an ambassador, you know, so, and then the role of education. I'm a retired teacher myself, so, I mean, you're hitting that button right on. And you mentioned about how under attack, And, you know, don't want to get off on the debate whether Trump is the cause or he's the symptom or anything like that. But nonetheless, it's out there. And you mentioned you have a husband, and so therefore a gay man. I want to talk about rights, okay? Not only in context of the LGBTQ community, but also for women, for racial minorities, for immigrants. It seems that, you know, we see advances, okay, for us, you know, to have the ability to marry the person of your choice, okay? But that comes back for women, Roe versus Wade, back under attack again. Talk about that in a both the broader sense, but then as a senator, how you could address that and make our reaction and strengthen our emphasis on human rights.
Yep. I mean, you know, as a human rights diplomat, I was proud to represent the United States around the world in almost 60 countries. And the principle that was the guiding principle for our work as we engaged with civil society groups and, you know, women's groups or groups of religious minorities in various places around the world was what is written in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which, by the way, Eleanor Roosevelt had the primary role, I think, in midwifing into the world, which is that we are born free and equal in dignity and rights. And that is a universal principle, which is also in our own constitution, obviously with different with different intent at the time. And it, our constitution came at a time where the original sin of slavery was still protected. But the values that underpin the Universal Declaration of Human Rights are liberal democratic values. And first and foremost is the idea that each of us is equal in our dignity and rights by virtue of being human. And I think that what one of the things that we see in this moment is a retreat and a revanchism, not only in Russia or in China or in other places around the world, but also in the United States. Race continues to be a defining organizing principle for our society in intolerable ways. It determines way too much about how people, what kinds of opportunities people will have in their life, and whether they will be able to live a life of their own choosing that we would recognize as being a life where they have the pursuit of happiness. Similarly, gender continues to be a barrier for opportunity for too many Americans. And obviously, half of them are women. And the LGBTQ community has been under attack by President Trump. And we've seen, as you said, the fact that progress is never fully won. You can't declare victory and go home because rollbacks are always possible. And we've seen rollbacks in the Trump administration in his kicking trans troops out of the military, saying that they aren't eligible for military service, affecting 15,000 patriots who volunteer to serve in our armed forces. We've seen the depriving LGBTQ people of access to health care. We've seen it in the ruling that came down last week that federal contractors would be allowed to discriminate in employment based on LGBTQ status. So, and we see it obviously in the fact that because of Cory Gardner and Mitch McConnell and their effort to confirm more right-wing judges, more judges than any president in recent history, many of them right-wing ideologues, we see it in the effort to roll back Roe v. Wade and seek to overturn it. And these laws that got that have been passed by state legislatures in Georgia and Alabama and Ohio and Missouri, these laws are not, there are many explanations for them. One is that, you know, the state legislature in Alabama is mostly men and hugely disproportionately so. But the other explanation is that Cory Gardner has helped Mitch McConnell put people on the federal bench that gives those state legislatures the idea that they might be able to overturn Roe v. Wade. And there were a lot of people who, when Cory Gardner ran the first time, thought that those of us who were concerned about the effect that this was going to have on a woman's right to choose were crying wolf or were overreacting. We can see now that there is a direct line between the election of Cory Gardner to the U.S. Senate and the attack on women's reproductive rights, and it is one of the many reasons why Coloradans cannot make the mistake of believing that Cory Gardner will be a moderate or independent voice when we know that he has folded for Donald Trump time and time again and will continue to do so.
Yeah, and not to go, but something I think it's a biblical. It's about them by their fruit ye shall know them, even bad fruit. Yeah. So,
shift gears. Or Shakespeare, though he may smile and smile, and yet be a villain.
Ah,
since Corey likes to smile.
Oh, indeed. And but then what's behind that
right.
smile there too in the eyes? So there you go, Shakespeare. English teacher here too, so excellent. I want to shift gears here and move over to me, if not the greatest, but the seminal issue of our time is climate change. We're seeing Greenland melting out.
Pretty soon it's going to just be up for sale.
Well, that's what we understand, and I'm thinking that the guy behind wanting to sell likes to develop golf courses.
So, right, yeah, exactly.
So it's all the better. And so not only that, but the Antarctica melting off.
The fires in Brazil right now are
exactly.
deeply concerned.
So talk about what can we do? What do you see our role as Americans? What can you do in the Senate that could help start addressing this, mitigate it? Because we're quickly getting past the tipping point.
We are. I mean, the two issues that I talk about first when I travel the state and talk with Coloradans, aside from the crisis and our, you know, this terrible moment that we're living through, which I think all of us need to reassure each other that we're going to keep fighting to get through this and get past it. But the two issues I talk about are reforming our democracy and getting big money out of politics, because if we don't do that, it makes everything else much harder. You can't get anything else done if you don't tackle the corruption that is at the center of our democratic process right now. And the second is climate change, because if you don't tackle that, then nothing else matters. My husband is a climate economist for the World Bank. He spends his time thinking about how we protect the global poor from the worst effects of climate change and natural disasters related to climate change. So this is something we talk about at the kitchen table. As Coloradans, you know, the outdoor industry is increasingly important in our economy. We know that there are public health consequences. There's been reporting out this year about the public health impacts of climate change already on Coloradans. And frankly, climate change makes the entire United States of America, it is a national security issue for us as well. And so as Coloradans, we're affected in a number of ways by the climate change that is already happening. And what Coloradans should want out of members of Congress, whether they're in the House or the Senate, is they should want people who are ready to be in the fray, who are ready to be, you know, laws don't just materialize on people's desks for a vote. We pay attention when people vote on laws, but what really matters is having people who want to be in the mix as laws are being drafted. And what's going to have to happen starting in January of 2021, when we win the White House and when we flip the Senate, what's going to have to happen is that there are a number of legislators who are willing to do the work of leading on climate change, and that won't be easy. It's going to be like a peace negotiation, because peace negotiations are very hard, because you have usually a bunch of different issues and a bunch of different parties, and different issues are important to different parties, and so nobody will agree to anything until all of it is agreed. And I think climate change is going to be, our response to climate change is going to be something like that, where we're going to have to make sure that we have a complex of legislation that will actually address the problem and that will meet the needs of Colorado and of California and of Tennessee and of New York and of the people living across the country. And in Colorado, for example, one of the things that we need legislators who recognize that we have a large number of our fellow Coloradans who work in the old energy economy, which is to say in the fossil fuel economy, oil and gas and coal. And those people and their livelihoods matter. And whatever transition we're going to make, because we must make for the future of our children and grandchildren and the planet, the transition that we make should be made with attention to being effective in mitigating the worst effects of climate change, but also attention to mitigating the worst costs of transition for our fellow Coloradans. And, you know, we need somebody who's committed to doing the work.
Yeah, and when you're talking about that, and you start addressing the question, Dan, you mentioned and you correlated the industry that's out there behind it. And I remember watching one of your videos, and you made a statement about America for sale. And so this thought jumps into mind for me about the correlation, difference between correlation, cause and effect. And I'm wondering if there really isn't a cause and effect, that the profit motive that we're still vested so much into the fossil fuel industry in particular is helping drive the policy decisions because people are going to understand. We quit buying gasoline, for example, or pumping it out of ground, and this industry is, okay, going to have to change in some way. People lose sight of the fact that it also creates another industry out there, okay, solar, whatever, right, like that. So, you know, I want to talk to you, because you mentioned that America for Sale, and I think it was in the more political context, you know, and, you know, like the Supreme Court decisions you mentioned, but also its relationship to climate change itself.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that this is specific to one industry. I think what we see in America right now is an increasing concentration of wealth in the very richest individuals and an increasing concentration of corporate power in very large corporations. And neither one of those is good for the competition that we actually see as at the heart of a capitalist economy, particularly when those who have the most wealth or the most corporate power have, to a large extent, captured the decision makers in our democracy. And, you know, one of the reasons why I said I would not accept corporate PAC money on day one of my campaign, and one of the reasons why I believe I'm the only candidate who said that he will never be a federal lobbyist, is because people get paid on the way into office with corporate PAC contributions, and they get paid on the way out with million-dollar contracts on K Street to be lobbyists, usually for large corporations, where they go back and sit down and have lunch with their friends in Congress and write the laws that are supposed to be defining the playing field. You know, the way that our democracy should work is that the laws should be written and enforced with an eye to justice, to being fair and good for the people of our country, and that companies and economic actors should compete within the boundaries set by those laws. Right now, we have a system where increasingly the companies and economic actors are writing the laws, are having huge influence on how the laws are written, and also huge influence on those who are supposed to be the referees, including cabinet secretaries like Wilbur Ross or David Bernhardt. You know, so we've got or Scott Pruitt, who used to be the head of the EPA. We've got a problem where you don't get genuine competition. People in this country are not against competition. We just want it to be fair. And increasingly, the playing field is tilted. And I think until we take serious action to untilt the playing field, people are going to remain skeptical about the fairness of the results that flow from it, including the massive spread and, you know, the massive income inequality, and the fact that, you know, in a country with as many billionaires as we have, we still have, you know, 1 in 6 children who are likely to go to bed hungry tonight in this country. We can disagree about how you solve that, but we can all agree that that's not right.
Well, build on that more. We'll segue over that, because that comes to mind for me when you talk about the wealth being, you know, sort of at the top there. And we haven't seen this much disparity between wealth at the top and the bottom since
the 1920s.
And back in the 1880s, it you know, our good friend Mark Twain dubbed the Gilded Age.
Yeah.
Okay. So since the 20s and the economic disparities that are in there. So, in terms of then, how do we start to close this gap to raise the working class, the middle class? There's a story, it's recently out, you probably heard about it, about this Chinese firm that took over the old GM firm in one of the towns in near Toledo or Dayton or something in Ohio. And the people were real excited that they were going to reopen it. Then when they get back there, they find out that they're only going to make $12 an hour, and with the intention they want to replace them, and the term they use is cancel. We're going to cancel them. So when we get this new robot in, these four people get canceled. How do we address that? Is there hope for rejuvenation? I grew up as a blue collar in the factory concept. I grew up near Pittsburgh, very much in my blood. Is that coming back? How do we do it then to start to build up this so that the economically lower classes can start making a respectable middle class living at least?
So I think there are kind of short term and longer term answers to what is obviously a very complicated question about the future of our economy and our society. In the short term, I think we can do two things. One, we can recognize that the approaches that we've been taking aren't working, and stop throwing good effort after bad in terms of the approaches. We need to think about new ideas for how we will adapt to the fact that the world has grown smaller because of globalization and the advance of technology, and that is having an effect on American workers and on their livelihoods, and that capital, which used to be largely immobile, I mean, it used to be that if you were a rich person, you likely owned land because that was where most wealth was, and so rich people couldn't move and poor people could because they were the workers who could move around. And now we have a kind of inversion of that where capital can move to Monaco or to the Caribbean or to wherever they want, and poor people are less mobile. And that has changed the dynamics of the society in which we're living. And we need to think about, yes, in the short term, we can support bargaining rights and make sure that unions have the right to organize and that workers can advocate for fair working conditions and wages, and we should do that. We also need to be thinking in the medium term about what is organized labor going to look like in 10 or 20 years, given the transformations we see in our economy, where more and more workers are working as independent contractors. Is that going to stay that way? Is it going to grow? Is it going to shrink? If it's going to stay that way or grow, how are we going to make sure that those independent contractors are, as economic actors, competing on a fair playing field and not being exploited by a concentration of corporate power at the top? These are important. We won't find the answers for any of these in a single conversation or in a single year. But I think what going back to where I started, I think it's important to recognize that what we have right now isn't working. So we have to have people who are willing not to just make incremental change, tweaking around the edges, but who are willing to think about how do we set up America to be a competitive, democratic, capitalist system for the 21st century where Americans thrive. And right now, too few Americans are thriving and too many are feeling swept under by the changes that have happened in our economy and in the world in the last generation.
Yeah, and there's been reports I read just the other day, and whether it's lip service or well-intentioned also, that the 100, almost 200 heads of corporations around the CEOs are starting to recognize this problem here because they could see the carpet being pulled out from underneath them. And I personally make a distinction between free enterprise and capitalism, mm-hmm. and how capitalism itself has the seeds of its own destruction within itself. It's called monopoly. Teddy Roosevelt recognized
that. Not if it's well regulated. I mean, the whole theory of it, nobody who's ever been a serious capitalist economist has imagined it happening in a vacuum. Like any competition, it needs boundary lines and referees and in order to do what it's supposed to do. Because the only reason why competition isn't a good in itself, competition is good because it delivers better for more people.
Right.
And when the competition is tilted or unfair, it doesn't deliver better for more people. And so we should fix it and make it fairer and make it a real competition.
Sounds somewhat or a whole lot FDR-ish.
Yes.
I like that, in there. So, and let's segue again, speaking of economics and so forth and income gap, but immigration itself, that it's anymore, it seems like it's getting reduced down to the racial component of it. Yet, I point out, my point of view is that people, especially from Central America or Mexico, are not coming here for the climate. They're coming here for opportunity because conditions are so poor in their conditions or in their countries, whether it's economic or the violence that's there. So they're looking for opportunity. The same as all of our grandparents, parents, great-grandparents, whatever, go all the way back to the original settlers that came here. Why come to America? They're repeating the whole thing there. How would you address it? How do you see, what could we do for the immediate on the immigration issue, but also long-term?
So, you're right that immigration has been part of the American story, obviously, since the beginning of European settlement.
It's in our DNA. I just wrote an article on that. Yeah, everybody's an immigrant in some way.
Except for Native Americans, and my youngest brother is Native American. One of my favorite political speeches in American political history is Ronald Reagan's farewell address, and in it he talks about how he's always used the metaphor of the city upon a hill, and he asked the question of how is the city on this dark winter night. And he finishes it by saying that America is still a beacon for all those who must have freedom, for all the pilgrims from all the lost places hurtling through the darkness toward home. And I think it's important to remember that this has never been as much a polarizing partisan issue in recent memory as it is today. And actually, one of the things that America is really good at, better than any country that I've ever been to, any modern democracy that I've ever been to in the world, mm-hmm. we're really good at taking people from anywhere in the world and 3 years later making them Americans. Yeah. It's actually a strength of our democracy that because it is founded on values and not on blood, yes. that we are able to bring people into a values-based society and make them as American as we are. And I think it's important that we recognize that as a strength of ours, because it is certainly the case that in the 21st century, the migration of people is a challenge that all governments are going to have to figure out how to address, because people have always moved, but the world is smaller and it is easier to move now. And there's more awareness of what things are like in other places, or at least whether those perceptions are accurate or not, that there's more communication going on. And so we can expect that people are going to move more and more. How we manage that is both a reflection of our values and our competence. And I would say on both counts, the Trump administration is failing miserably. They are implementing a broken set of immigration laws with malice and racism. And it's not making us safer. It's not solving problems. It's eroding both our values and the good function of our government. What do we need moving forward? First, we need to get the Trump administration out of office because we have to remove the malice. But then we do need comprehensive immigration reform. And this, too, is an issue where, like a peace agreement, you can't do it one-off. You can't solve one piece here and one piece there. You won't get agreement on anything until you get agreement on everything. The tragedy is obviously that Senator Bennett was part of the Gang of Eight that, you know, 6 years ago successfully negotiated a bipartisan bipartisan piece of legislation that was comprehensive immigration reform, and it got blown up by John Boehner because of political reasons in the House. We're going to have to do it again. It is the way forward, but we need leaders who are committed to doing that.
Okay. And there's so many other issues I want to get into before, and I want to touch on both potential role in the Senate and on the world scene. But before we do, can't go away from the national issues here without talking very quickly, and not necessarily cause and effect, but gun violence, the rise of the radical right here, and then the mental health issue, which keeps getting wrapped up in that. So if you could just comment on those a bit.
I mean, look, we have a white supremacist in the White House who gives cover and encouragement to some of the most morally odious views that have always been present in American society, but never been, but have not usually in recent memory been approved mm-hmm. in any public sense by certainly by the President of the United States. And it is a devastating moral stain on our country to have somebody who thinks that there are good people on both sides of neo-Nazi rallies and counter-protests. That is something that will take us some time to recover from. On the issue of gun violence, you know, I grew up about a mile and a half from Columbine. I was in college when the Columbine shooting happened. I had two siblings in public high school in Littleton. I remember walking across the quad and somebody telling me that more than 10 students had been killed at a public high school in Littleton, Colorado, and running back to my dorm room and phoning home, and the lines were jammed and I couldn't get through and find out how my siblings were. This is an issue that's been personal to me since I was young. I wrote my first op-ed for a newspaper in the fall of 1999 about the issue of gun violence, and I said that in response to a question that actually came from former Governor Lamb about what our generation should march for, I said we should march against gun violence because we were the generation that was growing up with this. Obviously, that was 20 years ago, and in many ways, it's deeply disappointing how little we've done. Colorado has done more than some places, not as much as others, but I think there's certainly, there's a to put it concretely, there's a piece of legislation that is dying on Mitch McConnell's desk right now that is a bipartisan universal background check bill. Jason Crow is one of the people carrying that bill, who carried that bill in the House. And we need leaders in Congress who understand that we are making the choice to live this way. We are making the choice to live with this, with the level of gun violence that we experience. And no other country, no other, modern democracy or modern economy in the world makes the choice that we do. And there's a reason why they don't, because it's not sane.
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that. And there's so many other areas I want to go into, but I know we need to get wrapping up here. So I'm going to just gloss over very quickly. I had some questions on the global issues, but you were an ambassador. So probably a lot of that remains, it might be obvious. I don't know, but you promise me you'll come back and we'll talk about.
Yeah, sure.
We could have a conversation just on the world scene and everything. But I'm going to do a couple things. As senator, how would you help restore the dignity that was once reserved? We used to call the U.S. Senate the world's greatest deliberative body. It looks like bedlam. It is just like a little dictatorship there with Mitch McConnell. How would you help restore the dignity to that and make it raise it to that level that it was back in the day when I grew up in the years before?
Well, I think part of it, first of all, I'm not sure it's not going to get worse before it gets better. So I'm not naive about it. But I think a couple of things. One, if Democrats are successful in taking back the Senate, and I hope we are, I hope that we also recognize that that's a moment for us to demonstrate leadership rather than revenge. That doesn't mean we should be Pollyanna-ish about, we need to get things done for people. And I think we should be prepared to work hard and fight hard to get things done. But I think we should be, what has happened in the Senate is the erosion of culture, not so much a change in rules. And the culture is what made people use the rules in good faith. And so what Mitch McConnell did to Merrick Garland was absolutely outrageous in not putting him up for a vote. But there was nothing against the rules in what he did. It was just a bad faith use of them. We should be the model for good faith use of the rules, and we should seek to lead rather than to get revenge. I think the other thing that is really crucially important is to recognize that the way that we can fix the culture of the Senate, the way that we can fix the function of the Senate, is by getting the Senate functioning again. And I know that sounds like a chicken and egg problem, but until we reset our economy and our politics, it's going to be incredibly hard to get anything other than the dysfunction. People think that it is a breakdown in civility that has caused the dysfunction. It's actually the other way around. When you have the bottom 80% of Americans seeing no raise over a generation, and those at the top having an enormous increase in wealth, you have a vast majority of Americans who are having to share a shrinking pie. It's not surprising that people draw new tribal lines on different boundaries that are not morally relevant and that we don't want them to draw when the pie is shrinking. And until we reset our economy and our politics to make it more fair and more representative, we're going to continue to see that there are structural forces that are forcing people to fight, both in our society, creating social hostility, and in the U.S. Senate. So part of what you can do in the U.S. Senate is to try to get America working, our democracy working again for more Americans, because that will create a opportunity for senators of both parties to do more good work together. And that's going to take leadership and drive and boundless energy and defiant optimism in the face of long odds. And that's what I want to bring to the Senate.
Okay. My final question. You're one of a dozen candidates right now for the Democratic nomination. Why are you positioned to be the best to defeat Cory Gardner?
Well, I mean, I think there are a number of things that make me a unique candidate. I'm the only candidate who has foreign policy experience. I'm the only candidate of those who have raised over $1 million who is not a career politician. I am a historic candidate in the sense that there's never been an openly gay man in U.S. history in the U.S. Senate. But I think the strongest argument is that in 2018, the candidates that we saw who were able to win in swing seats were candidates who looked like me. They were not the traditional conventional picks. They were not the people who had been conditioned by a life in politics to be incremental. They were people who were public servants first and who had a record in foreign policy or national security, who could reach out across the aisle, yes, and engage moderate Republicans. People ask me, how are you going to get moderate Republicans on board? And I say, it's not because I think they're going to be persuaded to agree with me on every policy issue. It's because they can trust that I represented 330 million Americans overseas for 4 years for President Obama. And I never once thought about which Americans voted for the president who put me there. I know what it's like to represent all of us. I want to represent all Coloradans, even those who don't vote for me. I am committed to listening to them. And, you know, one of the things you asked at the beginning about, you know, being a gay man, one of the things about growing up in Colorado in the time that I did, I was 15 when Amendment 2 passed in 1992. 15 is a particularly impressionable age, and I can remember thinking that this meant that my future was bleak. When I was 18 and graduated from high school, it was still illegal to get a security clearance if you were openly gay in the U.S. government. And less than 15 years after that, I was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State with a top secret security clearance. And less than 5 years after that, I was the youngest U.S. ambassador in the world with my husband by my side. Nobody who's lived the life that I've led can be cynical about the possibility of making progress through politics. And it also is a great reminder of the importance of being humble. My life has been possible because other people sacrificed, other people fought. I want to pay that forward, and I think that's exactly what we need in this moment.
Yeah, it's called hope in large part, too. So, need to wrap up. People want to get a hold of you, your campaign, what's your website, things like that.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from folks. You can find us on Facebook at Dan for Colorado, or you can find us on the web at www.danforcolorado.com, and the four is spelled out F-O-R.
All right. Excellent. Thanks, Dan. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9, visiting here with candidate for the Democratic nomination for the Senate, Dan Bayer. And check out his website for more. Okay, take care now. Bye.